Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. We bring you Marjan Satrapi this time. It's a talk from our 2007-2008 season. Satrapi is an Iranian-born French author and film director and is considered one of the greatest graphic novelists at work today. Her work includes the critically acclaimed graphic novels Persepolis and Persepolis II, which follow her life from Tehran to Paris. The film adaptation was featured at the 2007 Cannes Film Festival. Here's Marjan Satrapi at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall in Portland on Literary Arts, the Archive Project.
My goodness, it's even more impressive than what I thought it would be. I'm very scared. And I, at the same time, I feel very famous. After seeing this big hall with all these people inside, I think I will change profession. I will become a rock star next time. But okay, so good evening. I am extremely happy and honored to be here. Of course, I'm very impressed. I will first, talk about my work. And after talking about my work, of course, I will be extremely pleased and happy to answer to all your questions, because this is the most exciting part for me personally. I have gone through 1 year of promotion in which I have answered to the journalists that basically all of them, they have the same question. And the question, basically, they're all very boring. And no matter what your question will be, it's always 10 times more exciting what I'm normally used to. But before starting talking, I just wanted also to apologize for my English, because the English is not a language that I have learned. It's not my first or my second language. And with the jet lag and all this flight that I take every day, it doesn't arrange it neither. So I might and I will make lots of mistakes. So please be gentle enough to forgive it to me. So first of all, I will start, as I say, to talk about my work and to begin with the media that has been graphic, that has been called graphic novel for a long time, the term that I really don't like. I prefer my work to be called comics. Because as my very good friend Chris Ware say, graphic novel is a little bit like Lady Chatterley's Lover. You know, it's a little bit bourgeois 19th century, we don't know really. And I'm completely convinced that it has been, that is a term that has been created by the publisher, so people, they wouldn't feel ashamed of buying comic books and reading them. When their friends come over, you know, instead of saying, oh, I'm reading a comic, they will say, I'm reading a graphic novel. That sounds much better. But, you know, I made comics and I'm a cartoonist, and I really insist on that because I come from painting, basically, and I choose the media of comics because it was popular art, it was pop art, and I was not very much into this elitist art. I wanted to make a work that would be accessible to everybody, a work that would be intelligent, and at the same time, no matter what age or what cultural background that we had, we would be able to approach it. So that's why it's extremely dear for me to call that comics and not a graphic novel. Anyway, I didn't grow up, of course, in a culture of comic. Not that comic, they didn't exist in Iran. They existed. And even in Iran, it's something even better than that, is that we are used to have images going with a serious text, because the whole Persian poetry has been always illustrated by Persian miniature. So that the fact that a serious text would go with serious image, it was not something incredible, unbelievable for me. But comics is really something else. And in Iran, as I say, it was a lot of comics. It was basically lots of translation of Tintin and Asterix that my male cousin would read them, but not me, because it was no female character in them that to who I could identify. Actually, the only female character in Tintin was Castafiord, who was a mean, ugly old lady that, you know, as a young child, girl, I didn't want to identify to. But at the same time, I will tell you a story, I mean, out of this materialistic dialecticism. I had another comic book that I read as a child that actually stopped me from reading comics for 17 years after, and I will explain to you why. Actually, back in 1977, Iran was very much Americanized. You know, we used to go with my cousins, we used to go to a place called Big Boy, that you have it also in America, eating some burger, and then we would go to the bowling club of Abdo and play bowling and the whole thing. And between all this American thing, we had also a toy shop close to my house that were selling American comics. And when I was 7, with my smaller cousin who was 5, we went to this toy shop and we bought this comic called Dracula. At this time, I was going to a French school, and my small cousin, who was 5, as I said, he was convinced that I could read all the languages in the world. So he told me, can you read in that? And I was like, yeah, of course, no problem. Of course I can. So I started reading in this Dracula comics, and at one point, for some mysterious reason, I don't know why, I told him, you know, here is written that if you want to become Dracula ourselves, we have to eat raw chicken. So that was the beginning of the summer vacation. So we started stealing raw chicken from my mother's kitchen and his mother's chicken and our grandmother's kitchen, and we were just eating these pieces of raw chicken for 3 months. As a result, at the end of the summer, we got worms. And it was absolutely impossible to get rid of them. So that's why I stopped reading comics until the age of 24. Until actually I came to France, that was back in 1994, and as Elizabeth said it before, for my first birthday, they offered me this comics, Mouse of Spiegelman. And at this time, the idea that I had about comics is the idea that everybody else has about comics. That means it is reading for kids or adolescent or at the best retarded adult. That was my idea. And I was wondering, really, why do they give me these comics? And so I started reading it, and so far that was the best story that I ever read about Holocaust and the Shoah. I was extremely moved, and for somebody like me who came from, you know, who come from image, it was incredible to see that finally I found the media, a language that fitted me the best. At this time, I didn't know that I will make comics because, you know, making comics is a very long procedure. You know, not only you have to write a story, but then you have to make it into frames, and then you have to draw them, and then, since it's plastic art, then you have to draw them beautifully. It takes a long time, and one should be extremely obsessed to be able to make comics, and I didn't know that I was an obsessive person like that, but I realized it later on when I started making some. And really, when I started my work, it became like something obvious to use this media and not another media, which I say it's a media, it's certainly not a genre, because it helped me to have distance with the story. It helped me also to be able to use humor to say what I was going to say without falling into cynicism. It was important, actually, to use humor because, as you know, people around the world, we cry for the same reasons. You know, we cry because we are sick or because our mother is dead or it's sufficient to show, you know, and the image of a child dying in the arm of his parents, and anybody would cry. But we don't laugh, actually, for the same reason. Laughing is really, for me, touching the spirit of the other one. It's understanding, really, something abstract, concept in the other one. It's not anymore about materialistic thing like me hungry, thirsty, and, you know, you would give me something to eat. Or it's not something visceral like the sorrow that it's everywhere the same thing. Actually, I remember, you know, at the beginning when I came to America, I really didn't know American because they were keeping telling me jokes and I didn't find them funny one bit. You know, I was saying, why are all these people laughing? Or I was watching this show on TV that everybody else was laughing and I was like, this is not funny at all. And they didn't find me funny neither. And really the first time that I made a joke and people, they started laughing and vice versa, that was really the first time that I felt that I was knowing what was going on here. And this use of humor was very important for the story that I was saying, because, you know, since more than 20 years, as you know, Middle East, which itself is an abstract concept, because, you know, Middle East doesn't mean anything. Middle East, you know, is lots of different countries with different languages, different beliefs, et cetera, et cetera. But anyway, when we talk about Middle East, you have Middle East for 20 years, you know, you wake up in the morning, you have Middle East for breakfast, you have Middle East for lunch, you have Middle East for the afternoon tea, Middle East for dinner, Middle East all the time, and always Middle East with sufferance and people crying and what have you, and they're beating themselves and they just want to explode themselves and die, and, you know, all of that. And for me, the only way, because I thought that the humor went beyond everything else, I had to communicate the story in another way, and this use of humor was very, very important for me. And the comic gave me this possibility. And as I said before, it also gave me possibility to use this humor without falling into cynicism, because if there is something that I really hate overall in my life is cynicism. Because, you know, cynicism is a little bit like the Greek tragedy. We have to become cynical. Anybody in the world that has a brain, feeling, etc., you know, life is so much full of disillusion and full of disappointment and everything, that if we don't become cynical, it's extremely surprising. That's why I call it like a Greek tragedy. We have to become cynical. And that's why I don't want to become cynical. And that's why I hope that if the last day of my life, despite everything, I can still keep a couple of stars in my eyes, shining stars, of course, then I could say that I have made something important out of my life. And the comics, actually, this media helped me doing that. So here is about, you know, this media of comics. And after the comics, I started making this animated movie that I started 3 years ago with my best friend, Vincent Parronneau. And the idea of making a movie, it was not mine at all. At the beginning, when the book was published in America in 2003, actually I had some demands and requests from Hollywood. That was the most incredible request that you can imagine. You know, it was going from something that would happen, you know, in the desert in Morocco until something like the Siri Beverly Hills, you know about Beverly Hills, you know, but that would happen in Iran. So we would be this bunch of kids, you know, in Iran driving, you know, high-tech car, and a bomb would explode and ha ha ha, and then we would go to the university and hee hee hee, and they would stop me, and I was supposed to be called Kelly and my boyfriend Brandon and what have you. You know, I mean, no matter what I say about how personal my story is, when you write a story like that, I was responsible for what I wrote, and for me it was out of question to sell the story that, you know, they would make another version of Not Without My Daughter, in which the Iranian would be a little bit nicer this time. It was out of question, so either I had to make it myself or that should not be done at all. So then later on, you know, a friend of mine who wanted to become a producer told me, oh, and what about, you know, adaptation of Persepolis? And I told him that I thought that it was a very bad idea. I still think, I mean, now the result is good. I think it was good, but it was not a good idea, because it's not, first of all, because that you're a good cartoonist that someone would become a good movie director. That was the first thing. Plus, in comedy, since we have frame, we can have this tendency of thinking that it's sufficient actually to put a camera and film the frame one after the other, and suddenly we have the movie. I have heard so many times in my life that, you know, comics is like a storyboard for cinema, which is absolutely not true. Comics doesn't need literature, neither literature nor cinema to exist. Comic is a media for its own. And the storyboard of in the cinema is one of the work that we do before the movie is ready. So it has nothing to do. Plus, even the relationship that we have to the media is not the same. You know, when I write a comic, first of all, I can count on the activity of the reader to make the story, because unlike literature, of course, you don't imagine everything, but between the two frames, the movement should be imagined by the reader. So the reader has a very active relationship towards this media. When I make a movie, the viewer of the movie has an extremely passive relationship with the media, because when you sit in a theater and you watch a movie for 1.5 hour, everything is there. You don't need to be active. So this activity and the passivity of the viewer or the reader towards the media make it completely two different things. Another big difference is that in comics, you know, when I make a book, I have all the space to do whatever I want. I can make a comic of 1,000 pages, you know, I can write whatever I want. Unfortunately, we are not in 1920, and Eric von Stroheim is dead, and nobody wants us to make 8 hours movie. I would have loved to do that, but, you know, now it has to be 1.5 hours, 2 hours, etc. So we have to take one part of the story, one side of the story, and then develop this side. Otherwise, it's impossible, you know, to put 16 years of a life into a movie, because at the end, I would find myself with 5 movies in one, which is a disaster. And that's why the movie was made, you know, like a flashback, because at the time I was writing it, that was a very nostalgic and melancholic time of my life. So the whole structure was a flashback of this woman going into the airport, doesn't have any ticket to go back into her country, but she goes anyway, and she sits there, and she remembers all her life. The turning point of the story is, of course, the exile. Everything leads to this exile, and this exile justifies whatever comes next. But anyway, after all what I say, before starting this movie, I was not so much convinced that it would be a good idea, and that's probably we succeeded the movie because we were very scared of doing it and because we thought it was not a good idea. It sounded a little bit like a business plan, like, you know, now I made a book that has worked, now I'm going to make a movie that is going to work. But it was really not like that. This friend of mine who made me this proposition of adapting Persepolis, you know, just because he was insisting and insisting, and at the end I told him, okay, then we make an animated movie, we make it in black and white, it has to be hand-drawn, the studio should be in the center of Paris, Catherine Deneuve should play in the movie, I want this, I want that. And he said yes to all of it. And then I was like, shit, now I have to make the movie. And it was really like that, you know, because for me, you know, it was like diving into the water and then realizing that I didn't know even how to swim. I had to learn everything. I remember at the beginning of the project, they would tell me, do you want, you know, more like this thing of 3D, or do you want more of this? And I didn't understand at all what they were talking about. And I was saying a little bit of both, you know. And it was really a problem. Another big problem was that I'm a very solitary person, and, you know, I used to make my comics, you know, in my studio, on my table, without any money, you know, because with $500 maximum, you can make, you know, beautiful comics. I can buy the best Japanese paper and the best Chinese ink, and it's done. You know, the movie, you have all this money and all of that involved, and plus, I had to work with 100 people, and the solitarian person that I am, for me, it was unbearable. Believe me, when I started working with these people, the first 6 months, I wanted all of them to die. And I was, every morning, you know, they were coming like, hi, and in the morning, I'm in a very bad mood, I was like, eh. And then, you know, and then I had to be nice, I had to answer to their question, plus they wanted to draw like me, plus I had to see them every day, you know, it was like too much for me. I was saying, God, make them disappear so I don't see them anymore. And then suddenly in the middle of the project, these people, they started working, you know, so much, much more than what they had to and what they were supposed to do. These people, they put so much heart and so much, all their talent, whatever they had, they put it in this project. They really embraced this project and carried it with themselves, that I started appreciating them. And at the end of the project, I started really loving them, but that was the end of the project, and that is the story of life. So that is how that happened. But in the both work that I made, that is for the movie or for my comics, I always use this media of drawing. That this media of drawing always is a problem for people. And I try to explain why it is the problem and why is it that it would be absurd that it would be a problem. Because since I've been making comics all the time they have asked me, why did you make a comic book? And why didn't you make a book? Well, I made a book. You know, I mean, what is a book? A book is something with pages as a cover, an author, you read it, it's a story. But my books are books. The only difference is that part of the narration is made by the drawing, because that is the specificity of comics, is that it's not illustration that come to illustrate what has been already said. The word and the images, they work together, and we actually write with drawing. Whatever I don't write, I will draw, and whatever I will write, I won't draw. So both of them work together. And it was a curious question to me, because, you know, nobody would ask a singer, for example, why do you sing and why don't you dance, you know? Well, it's a singer. But, you know, for me, it's... Okay. Then the second thing came animation, and it was, oh, why did you make an animated movie, and why didn't you make a real movie? Well, I made a real movie, you know? I mean, it's the same thing, you know? I had to direct the actors and and make the editing, and, you know, the whole thing is the same. Plus, we have to draw everything, and we have to draw 12 images per second. And the movie is 5,400 seconds, so you count, you know, how many images you... So it's just more long and more painful. That's the only difference. But again, you know, it was that. And I think the problem with the drawing comes from basically two things. The first thing is that all the kids, without exception, around the world, everybody draw, everybody. And at the age of 10, it's a natural selection that is made between the kids themselves, that only the one who are supposed to become great artists later has the right to continue drawing. And 99.9% of the kids, they stop drawing. And, you know, I'm not inventing these numbers. You know, it's really statistics. So for 99.9% of the people, actually drawing is something that belongs to the childhood. So whenever you talk about drawing, it's something childish. This is the first thing. The second thing is also our educational system, and that is not only in America or in France, that is the same around the world, is that very quickly, very soon, we learn how to talk about the text. We know that the author wanted to say this, and the poet wanted to say that. All this thing that they said that the poet wanted to say, that basically maybe the poet was just drunk when he wrote all of that, you know. Should never forget that, because when they talk about my work, you know, they find some virtue in my work. Is that the point?
People are having trouble with the sound.
Oh, I have to go closer.
Yeah,
okay.
Sound okay?
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, I was talking about the drunk poet. So I didn't forget. So because, you know, when they talk about my own work, is about the same thing. You know, they find some very intelligent, you know, intensity in my work that I never thought about it. You know, I love hearing people talk about my work because I feel so intellectual, so intelligent, is unreal. But we know to talk about these things, but we don't know how to talk about the drawing. What makes it that, you know, this drawing is a good one and this one is not? We don't have the tool. So the fact that we think that the drawing belongs to the childhood for most of us, plus the fact that we don't know how to deal with it, is that we reject the drawing. And at the same time, it's absurd to reject the drawing, because the drawing is the first language of the human being before writing. Before that, the human being used the alphabet and the writing, the human being used to draw in the cave, you know, to go over their fear. It's something international about the language of drawing also, that you should, as Elizabeth said again, when you show a sad or a happy face, there is no country in the world, you know, no culture, that they will look at it, a sad face, and they will say, oh, this man is laughing. It doesn't exist. So we have an immediate relationship with the drawing that we actually don't have with the words. And at the same this is bizarre for me. And at the same time, I think that the drawing is even beyond the photography, because photography is, in a way, you know, taking the nature the way it is and presenting the nature the way it is actually created. The drawing is a way that a human being sees what the world around himself and recreate the world around himself. So that is, human being put himself in the situation of God and recreating the world in his own image. So it is something even closer to the human being by the drawing than the photography even. And for the movie that I made, this drawing, they were extremely useful because it was really a decision that we made to make this animation, not that we couldn't make, a real feature movie. No, that was not the case. It was for three main reasons I decided with Vincent, both of us, to make an animation. Because first of all, we wanted the story to go beyond Iran. Of course, the story happens in Iran. Of course, the background is there. Of course, the political background is there. But the fact that a human being lives in a place that suddenly all the reasons, all the other reasons become so much bigger than in the individualistic reason, that the individual is completely suppressed and oppressed. And how does this individual to deal with that? And how do we do to grow up? And how do we do to live? Because to live, it's not sufficient to be alive. We need a little bit more. And how is exile, et cetera, et cetera? They are themes that are international, they're universal. And the problem is that as soon as you put the action in a geographical place with some type of human being, is extremely difficult to identify to. That is geography that we are not used to, and there is some type of human being that we are not used to see. So we don't know, and since we don't identify, it becomes again the story of these people, Middle Easterner, fanatic, terrorist, whatever, what have you. They are far from us, we cannot understand it. But the drawing is abstract, and it makes it much easier to identify to a drawing. So that was the first reason. The second reason is that in the movie, we have many layers of narration. It goes, from the family scene to the war scene to the puppet scene, to more surrealistic scene like the meeting with God and Karl Marx and all of that. And either my name would be Federico Fellini, and I could make a movie going from one narration to the other with a lots of grace. But as you know, my name is not Federico Fellini, and I could have made something extremely vulgar. And this animation in black and white actually helped us to make a movie that would have a coherence from the beginning until the end, despite all this different narration. And the third reason is that Vincent and I, both of us, we were cartoonists, and drawing is the most easy thing for us to do in life. So for all these reasons, we use the animation. So now I would a little bit also talk about how this idea of this book came in the first place, because it was not like, one day I woke up and I said, oh, okay, now I'm going to write about the story of my country based off my own personal story. It didn't happen this way. I left Iran two times in my life. The first time, that was back in 1984. When I was 14, I went to Austria. And the second time, that was in 1994 when I went to France. And the both time, actually, I was confronted to the same problem. The lack of knowledge of people and all the misconception that they would have. Back in 1984, it was even worse because you know how the human being we are. We always need to know where the evil is. The evil is a specific thing, is in a specific place. One time it's called the UFO coming from the planet Mars. Another time is the communist, then is Khomeini, then is Saddam, then is I don't know what. In 1984, Iran was the evil. But today we are just the axis of evil, part of it. So, as you see, we improve ourselves. But back in 1984, really, we were really the evil. And, this one word answer to the question that for everybody is one word, like, where do you come from? From Portugal, Italy, America, whatever. For me, it was 3/4 hour of explanation. Like, yes, I'm Iranian, but my father doesn't have 5 wives. No, I'm not a mullah myself. No, we don't ride in the back of a camel. No, yes, I know what is electricity. Yes, I have been to the movie. I escaped some place you know, for some reason, believing that I was going somewhere to find the freedom and, you know, the understanding people who would support me. And I was judged by the thing that I was escaping from. And believe me, even at the age of 14, I did understand something that probably most of the people, they don't want to understand, is that even in a democracy, you know, the president of a country is not representative of all the people. You know about that, don't you? So imagine in a country like Iran that is called a dictatorship, if all the people, they agreed upon what was happening, then we would be called, you know, the biggest democracy in the world. You know, then why would it be called a dictatorship? It's a dictatorship and they need to dictate and put us in prison because we don't agree with them. And the whole time that I was in Austria, these 4 years that I was in Austria, I was hoping that one day I would speak a very nice German and I will explain this whole situation to my Austrian fellow. Unfortunately, the day that I spoke a very good German, I was homeless. And when you're homeless, you don't have anybody to talk to. So, you know, this first try to explain didn't give anything. And then I came to France. And again, that was the same problem, because when I came to France back in 1994, I thought that France, you know, the country of culture and, you know, and they have imported Iranian cinema, they would know better. They didn't know any better, because before I arrived to France again, this movie Not Without My Daughter went to France. And believe me, this movie made such a harm to us, suddenly because of the misdoing of one person. You know, a whole country was judged. Suddenly we were these people that they were washing themselves once per year. Like, I should be a very stinky person, you know. Like, we were eating cockroach in our rice, you know, that the movie was this people supposed to be Iranian, you know, barking some words that was not Persian, because I didn't understand one word of what they were saying. And all of that. And all the time I had to justify myself. And I kept on telling this story, you know, trying to say, you know, small story that would make the connection with the other one, to make them understand that it was not the way they thought. Until one day, you know, I read this sentence of this great Italian writer who is Umberto Eco, who say that for him, writing was the only way to express himself without being interrupted. And that is certainly why I made my book. It's not, as you can see, I like to talk, you know. It's not like I don't die. I like it very much. But, you know, I don't like to be interrupted. And certainly I don't like to repeat myself. So I said to myself, you know, I will just write it. And like that, it is done. And it was extremely important for me to make it, you know, from my personal point of view. Because I didn't have, it was even not important, I didn't have any way out. Because, you know, I'm not a politician, and I'm not a historian, and I'm not a sociologist. I don't have the pretension of being any of that. I don't have the knowledge for that. I'm a person who is born in a certain place, in a certain time, that I can be completely unsure and uncertain about everything in life that is something that I know, is something that I have seen and I have experienced with my own eyes. And so that was the only way to make the story, that it wouldn't become a political or a historical or a sociological statement. And that's why I wouldn't call my work an autobiography, because an autobiography normally is a book that you make because you have problems with your family and friends and you don't dare to say it to them. So you make a book and, you know, you solve your problem with people. Believe me, I'm not like that. I mean, basically, if I like people and I have problem with them, I will say to them. If I don't like them, you know, I just forget them and that's it. But the book is not a place for that for me. And that's why I wouldn't call it an autobiography. I used myself to be able to describe what was around me. And that is most probably one of the reasons, out of the fact that I'm extremely talented and my books, they are the best in the world, as you know. The reason that I think this book, they worked, was that, you know, that was an individual, that was a very personal, one-person point of view. And it's very easy, again, to identify after the drawing to one person, because a group of people, a nation, what is a nation? This is also abstract. A nation is full of different sorts of people. In even a little group of five people is abstract. So and there's nothing more universal than the human being. And I think it's about time that the human being would be in the center of interest, because we talk about everything but the human being. And this important of this individual point of view was that anybody, of course, could relate to. But also the time that I started writing this book, it was a good timing for me, because I started writing Persepolis, that was in 1999. That means that that was 5 years after I left Iran. And thanks God that I waited these 5 years, because at the beginning in 94 when I came, I was so angry. I was full of anger, and I was full of hate and full of violence, and I just wanted blood. I just wanted revenge. That is what I wanted. And these 5 years that I lived in France, I could afford myself the luxury of civilization, because believe me, civilization is a luxury. You know, we have to have to be able to eat and to have a roof and not be in a stressful situation to be able to be civilized. Out of that, civilization is the biggest bluff that they have ever told us. Just take the example of a city like Paris, you know, city of the light. You just empty the supermarket for 1 week. You cut the electricity and the gas. Believe me, within 1 week, people, they will start eating each other. So if we want people not to eat each other, probably everybody should have to eat. That's how we can be civilized. So at this time, actually, because I was living peacefully, I could afford myself, as I said, the luxury of civilization and take distance, because that is the only way of thinking. I think that free thinking is based on the fact of taking distance, not necessarily having answer to everything, not necessarily trying to condense everything in small sentences, trying to find very quick response to extremely complicated and complex question, but to take a step back, to take it a distance. If we don't take distance with the thing and think about them, we can never, ever pretend that we are free thinker. That is the basic of free thinking. So these 5 years also gave me the possibility to take a step back and not to work with my emotion, and that was to work with my art and with my intellect, because any intellectual and any artistic word, by definition, is an anti-fanatic work. Fanaticism press on the button of emotion. Press on the button of emotion and you have people going out and yelling and killing and, you know, shouting and making war. Very easy, because you play with their emotion. When you make an intellectual and an artistic work, when you don't pretend that you have answer, but you only have question to ask, when you make this work, not only to the person who reads you or listens to you, not only you ask them to be smart, but also to make a work to try to find the answers themselves. In the long run, this kind of thing works much better. In short term, it doesn't work, of course. Of course, in short term, emotion works much better. But if we want to construct a word, maybe we have to think in a long-term thing. So that's why it's important to take this distance, and that's why, for me, it was important to ask this question out of myself, from myself, excuse me. And while when I started, you know, reading the book, I also realized that everything is a matter of point of view, and it depends exactly where you situate yourself, that the whole story would change. It's a little bit like the movie Rashomon of Akira Kurosawa, when five people, they look at the same event, and each of them tell the story, and it's a complete different story of the other one. None of them lies, actually. None of them. It's just difference of point of view. You know, I remember, you know, as a child, when I was growing up in Iran, we were reading about, you know, this Persian-Roman wars. So in our history book, that was we, the Persian, we were the brave one, and we went into Roma, and we kicked them all, and we were glorious and victorious. That was great. Many years after, I went to Italy, and I read the history book of the kids that they were learning their history. And that was the Persian-Roman wars again. And they, the Roman, they went into Persia, and they kicked them all, and they were the glorious, victorious, pa-pa-pa. Both of the point of view are true, but it depends where you situate yourself. Or to give you a closer example, you know, like when I wrote my book, one of the questions that came over and over in America was that, why didn't you talk so much about the hostage taking? Well, the problem is that the hostage taking was a big deal for you. Believe me, it was not a big deal for us. Of course, because it was your hostages to start with that changed the whole thing. But you have to understand that, you know, the policy of American government, and please don't take me wrong, you know, I love American people. You know, I'm talking about American government, was not extremely glorious, you know, in this region after the 50s. That was coup d'etat and supporting dictatorship and, you know, CIA and the whole thing. And it was normal for these people that they have suffered. These people, you know, that once they nationalized all their oil in 51, and President Truman at the time, he wanted to support this democratic movement, but Eisenhower came and he destroyed the whole thing, with the British making a coup d'etat in 53. They were sick of presence of American in the country. They didn't want them to be there anymore. I think you can understand. I mean, imagine if people, they came into your country and told you what to do. You wouldn't like it neither. So we didn't like it. So we took the hostages. That was the way it was. So it just, I'm not saying that, you know, I mean, poor them, you know. I'm not underestimating that, but it's just to understand that it's always another point of view. It depends, you know, where you situate yourself. And so that is how I tried to make my work. You know, when I started to making my work, that was back in 1999, when I wrote Persepolis 1. And, you know, originally in France, you know, this book came out in 4 volumes. You know, it's not that you have less, and don't worry. You know, the 1 and 2 is volume 1, and 3 and 4 is the volume 2. But, you know, each year that was one volume of Persepolis that came out. And the situation of the world in 99 was, in a way, you know, the wall of Berlin fall down, you know, that was the end of the Cold War, etc. That I thought, in a way, that there is some hope for the future. And I was thinking that when in 2003 the 4th volume of my book will come out, there won't be any need of this book anymore. You know, unfortunately, I was wrong. You know, back in the same year, 1999, that was the first time that I came to America with my Swedish husband. And, you know, when you arrive to American immigration, that is when they put a stamp in your passport to say how long you can stay in the country. And me, with my Iranian passport, I got a 9-month visa, and my Swedish husband, he got a 3-month visa. He was not very happy, of course, and so he went to see the officer and say, how come she has a 9-month visa and I have a 3-month visa? The officer looked at him and told him, because she's cute and you're not. Two years after, you know, after September 11th, we came back to America, and I was the same cute girl, you know, nothing changed. I was just as cute as before. And they stopped me and put me in the room, 2.5 hours, you know, weapon of mass destruction, and what do you do here? You know, and nothing changed, but everything changed at the same time. And believe me, today with my French passport, nothing has changed neither, because not only they ask me about the weapon of mass destruction, but once that is finished, they ask me if I have cheese in my bag, which is, you know. With each new nationality, I have a new problem. So, you know, that was how it was back in 1999. And today, unfortunately, as I say, in 2003, it was more need to a book like mine than ever. I wished I never had to write a book like that, because that meant that it would have been a much better situation. But the world has changed. The world has changed, you know, we are living in a world that we are dehumanizing everybody in all the part of the world. Because, you know, out of the consistency that this dehumanizing has, you know, when we talk, for example, about Middle Easterner and fanatics and terrorists, it's condescended not to consider them as individual. But it's a bigger problem with that, is that from the second that these people become abstract notion again, when we forget that these people, they are human beings, when we forget that these people, like myself, they have hope and dreams and parents and love, that these people also, they have the right to live. They have also the right to breathe. They have also the right to dream about this future. Then it becomes extremely easy to go and bomb them and kill them. And who cares if 30 or 40 or 300 of them dies every day? Who cares? They are just Middle Easterners. They are not human beings anymore. We forget that they are human beings. And that's why all my work, I tried to put, you know, as I said, the human being in the center of interest, trying to humanize people, trying to say that it's not a mass of people. It's an individual with individual story. Unfortunately, we are also living in a world that has made us believe that democracy is a color with which we paint the wall, and suddenly we have a democratic country. But even worse than that, democracy is a gift that we can give to people by going and bombing them and killing them. And, you know, the role of the media and the role of the politician and this whole cynicism, it's a very bad time of life, you know, that we are living in, because normally when that is a war against something, first of all, we know our enemy. We don't know who is this enemy. I mean, who is the terrorist? Where are they? We don't know when this war started. We don't know when it's going to be finished. So it's a very scary moment of life. But, you know, to give myself a little bit of hope, I have made a mathematical calculation to understand what is going to happen. I take the date and I take 50 years off. So, you know, like year 2000, that was like 1950. You know, think about it. I'm not this far from being through. Huh? You know, now we are like in 58. Within 10 years is going to be a sexual revolution and everything is going to cool down a little bit. So that will be nice. I'm waiting for it. But anyway, now, before answering to your question, I just want to finish my speech talking about three things that are extremely important to me. So if you are patient, two more minutes with me that I will tell about that. The first thing that is an expression, a very villain expression that has entered into our languages since a couple of years, is this clash of culture, which I really don't understand. This clash of culture, first of all, it doesn't exist, because culture is like the ring of the same chain. Culture is related. You don't have the culture of a country that is only the culture of this country that has not had any influence with anything else. This is not true. I mean, the African art has influenced Pablo Picasso, who himself has influenced generation of modern artists, as much as, you know, the poem of Khayyam that was translated by the British Fitzgerald was a big source of inspiration to the French poetry of the 19th century, going from Paul Verlaine to Baudelaire to all of that. So in a way, culture, it communicates and it influences. So culture is international and it belongs everywhere. And clash of culture, that means that you have two forces that comes like that. The result of that is zero. We can talk about the differences of culture, so differences of point of view, not talking about this clash or this subtraction, but like addition, like differences of point of view, maybe all together can give us a panoramic point of view, and it's always good to have a wider point of view. The second thing, another villain thing expression that has entered into our languages, is this division of the world that now they want us to get used to, that is north and the south, you know, east and the west, which is absurd, you know, because the earth is round and you're always at the west or at the east of somebody. But anyway, the Muslim and the Christian, what have you. You know, like today, it's sufficient to be Muslim and you are violent. You know, people, they forget that, you know, the time of Inquisition by the Christian, and the way the priest, they killed this poor old lady that they were curing the sick people better than the church themselves, calling them witch, burning them into the public places, etc., etc. You know, this division of the world is not there. I mean, what is, for example, the common point between me and a fanatic of my country? None. What is the common point between an American liberal and, let's say, for example, George W. Bush? None. What is the common point between George W. Bush and a fanatic of my country? Everything. Believe me, everything. Come on. I mean, both of them, they're God's best friend. One said, read the Bible. The other one said, read the Quran. One is fighting the big Satan. The other one is making a crusade against the axis of evil. It's the same terminology, it's the same language. But when it comes from a fanatic of my country, this bearded guy, everyone knows about it, that he is a fanatic. You know, we know it. When it comes from the president of the biggest secular democracy in the world, shaved, well-dressed, that becomes extremely, extremely dangerous. And democracy is something extremely fragile. All this small freedom that they take from us in the name of I don't know what, war against what. We should be very careful about that, all of us together. So if there is a division, thank you. So if there is a division in the world, and I do believe that there is a division in the world, is between the stupid fanatics and the rest of the people. Believe me, we in number, we are much more, but we are not working on emotion as they do, because we are not fanatic, we are not crazy like them, so we are not loud like them. But if we know that we are many in numbers, maybe hand in hand we can do something, and I do believe we can do something. And there is not so much that I do believe, and to tell you the truth, I mean, I have lost all my illusion, and there is not so much things that I do believe in life. But that is going to be my last point. If in life I don't believe in nothing, still there is one thing, one single thing that I do believe in, that is the importance and the role of education and culture. Not that education and culture solve all the problem, but education and culture help us to be less stupid. And in life, you may admit that it's always better to be less stupid than more stupid. Thank you very much. Okay, now I'm going to answer this question. It's nice. I have never had that like that written on a paper. So I've heard that from all your books, chicken with plum is your favorite. Can you talk about why? Okay. Chicken with plum is my favorite book for many, many reasons. First of all, from a literary point of view, is the more advanced one. And then my drawing is better in chicken with plum than anywhere else. But also, is another thing, is chicken with plum, you know, the main character is a man. And, you know, as soon as I write a story where the main character is a woman, it's always identified to myself. So I always kind of take care, you know, watch what I'm saying a little bit. The main character in the book is a man, and that is where I found myself the most free to write whatever I wanted to, because, you know, this relationship was not this immediate. So it gave me a lot more pressure to write it. Also, I love the story. It's a love story. It's a nice love story because it ends bad, you know. That's the new, the real nice love story is. No, but come on. I mean, if Romeo married Juliet, would we be talking about them ever? No. So it's a very sad story, and I like sad stories. It is like life that ends with death, so that is like the real life. That's why. Okay, why do you enjoy most about your life as an artist? Why do I enjoy everything? You know, the fact that of not having a boss, for example, is a very good thing, because since my childhood I had problem with authority, and that was, you know, in my life, actually, I have only been hired once, and I worked for 40 minutes. They kicked me out. So it was not possible to do it otherwise. Yes, it's challenging. It's extremely stressing at the same time. But yeah, I think that is the life that I have chosen, so that's why it fits me the best. Okay, what are you working on now, and what is next for you? What am I working on now? Nothing. Because for 1 year, actually, I have gone into the promotion that not only I had to repeat the same thing over and over and over and over, and when you repeat something like 1,000 times, it was a moment for me that I felt that I was a radio, you know, like a tape, something. And I had the feeling that I didn't believe in what I was saying anymore. And I started hating myself because it's nothing worse for me than saying things that I really don't believe in. Plus, you know, this is that was the movie based on my book, based on my own life. So for 1 year, I was going on, me. And, you know, I was like really bored of myself. And I arrived to the point that I was extremely poor. You know, my soul right now is very poor. So I need to read a lot. I need to see a lot. I need to just, you know, smell and look and watch. And after, you know, I will be get full again. Then I will restart working because, you know, you have to believe in what you do, and I have to have something beautiful to say. Otherwise, why should I say it at all? So after this tour, to be very precise about the story, I'm going to take some vacation, and after that, if I'm alive, I will write another script. So, do you listen to the music while you work, and what kind?
Oh, all of that.
Okay, let's go for it. Okay. I don't know. I don't listen to music when I work because I really listen to music. When I listen to the music, I cannot work at the same time. But once in a while, for me to work, I need to be stressed. So to just, you know, get the stress up, once in a while, I put Sex Pistols. I am an anarchist. And I shout very loud with it, and then I'm like, fresh. I can go for it. That's what I do. I know a little about the revision process in writing. What it is like for drawing is extremely painful. You know, especially that, you know, in comics, you know, you have to do both of them at the same time. And drawing, because the first draft, we can have this tendency to think that it's the best draft, but most of the time it isn't. It's always nicer to look from another angle, you know, and all of that. So it takes a long time. So it's a painful process. I try to go fast to answer to all the questions. Which writer and artist are in your inner circle? Oh, I didn't know I had an inner circle. I don't know. There are too many to say, but, you know, I'm a big fan of Dostoevsky, of course, very big fan. I think that's probably why I didn't want to become a normal writer, because once you read Dostoevsky, you say, okay, I rest my case. So I love Flaubert also. Yeah, that's a lots of writer and lots of artists. The list would be too long. Have you found out yet what Matthias does for a living? Matthias is my husband. I still don't know what he does. This is the answer. What was it like to go to the Oscar? Oh, my goodness. The Oscar, you know, it sounds very fancy, you know, like, oh, I was an Oscar nominee, I went to the Oscar. But it was an extremely painful day because, you know, for making, like, I don't know, like 100 meters, you have to sit 5 hours in a car that doesn't mean anything. Then the thing is extremely long and all of that. And, of course, if you lose against a rat, that makes it even more painful. So, if you could hear from your school teacher, how would they describe you as a young student? I don't know. Some of them, they really liked me, but that was also the one that I liked, and there were not so many. So, do you enjoy other graphic novels? Please name them. Yes, I enjoy lots of comics. This person didn't listen to me. Huh? And basically, the best comics that I love are the American cartoonists. I mean, of course, I named Art Spiegelman, but it's also Chris Ware that I love. That is Joe Sacco, who actually lives in Portland. If Joe, you're here, I don't know if he's here, but anyway, he's just great. I love also the work of Linda Berry, and of course Robert Crumb. I'm just a huge, huge fan. Why the name Persepolis? Why not Shiraz or Isfahan? Well, Persepolis actually not only is the ancient capital of Persia, that is the name that the Greek gave to a place called Tahtijamshid, but also Persepolis in Greek, that means the city of Persian. In a way, it is Iran. And I always thought to make people understand, you know, the situation of today in the country, it was a little bit good to make them remind that it's a big historical past to this country because, you know, unfortunately, Iran is known mostly after 1979. I mean, that's Iran before 1979 that has a king and a queen and flying carpets, you know, 1001 Night and Shahrazad and all of that. And then you have an Iran after 1979 where the king and the queen, they became the guardian of the revolution and the flying carpet became the flying rocket, but that is the flying rocket part that is most remembered. So even though if I don't talk so much about this historical past, I think that the name would remind people that is that the country they are talking about is the same country with this huge past. That explains a lot of what is happening today in our country. You know, just to be more precise about what I'm saying is that, you know, for example, if you look from far, you can say, if the Iranian, you pretend that Iranian people, they are not happy, etc. So why don't they make a revolution? So, but if you know the history of the 20th century in Iran, you realize that this 1979, that was not the first revolution that Iranian made. The first revolution that was made in 1906 to install a constitutional monarchy, people died. Then that was 1979, we made the revolution believing that democracy would come. People died. It didn't give anything. Then 1900, before that, 1951, we nationalized our oil. As a result, it was a coup d'etat. Other people died. Then 1980, that was this war with Iraq that is by far the biggest war of the modern history after the Korean War. More than 1 million people died. You know, the Iran-Iraq war just finished in 1988. That is 20 years ago. You know, the young people that lost an arm and leg, you know, that they were injured in the war, who by then was, they were 20 or 23 or 24, they're just 40, 43, 44 years old. They're still young men. So, you know, a country needs a time also to recover. So it's not that people, they are just passive. It's that we also need a time to recover. So that's why. That was a long answer. Do you still have conversation with God? And if so, why? What does he say? You know, I think, you know, this question of believing God or religion, you know, is I don't have anything, you know, really against any religion or any belief, nothing at all. I do believe that this is a very private domain that everybody has to keep for themselves. From the second we think something and we bring this idea out and we want to convince other people, that is the beginning of the problem. If any believer could keep their belief for themselves, we would live in paradise. And that's why I won't say what he tells me. Okay, what do you think about this the outlaw against cigarettes? And if after the lecture I will have a cigarette, of course I will have a cigarette, not only one, five, six. I think this law is a nonsense. For me, it's a rape of individual freedom. Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, First of all, this law, that means that the government, the state, put themselves in the situation of the father, and we are this poor kid who don't know how to behave, so daddy tells us what to do and not what to do. Second of all, if a government took care really about our health, they should change the condition of working. People, putting people in the cube, you know, this is not the best way of treating people, you know. Give them more vacation, give them social, you know, the health care, give them, you know, some stuff like that, you know, the cigarette come next, and put all this pollution and all of that. Anyway, I don't understand why adult people, they cannot decide by themselves that they can have a bar where they can go and smoke. Plus, bar is a place for a smoker. Plus, I will finish by something else. You know, Joe Strummer, the singer of Clash, he says something. It was great what he said, actually. He said, for all these anti-smoking people, no major work of art and literature and cinema came out of the hand of a non-smoker in the 20th century. So for the one who hates smoker, they should never watch a good movie, and they should never read a good book, and they should never go to museum. That's my response. Who do you hope is elected for the next president of the United States and why? Barack Obama, of course. And why? Because he's the only one who is not a real politician. That means, excuse me, but he doesn't talk bullshit. He tries to show that the situation is complicated. Plus, you know, he's extremely loved in all over the world, and I think for America it's very good to have a good relationship, you know, with the world outside. Okay. Why did you choose to settle in Paris after leaving Iran? For example, the USA, why didn't you come here? Okay. Well, I settled actually in Paris because I spoke French, because all my scholarship was made in France, and, you know, I had enough of my years in Austria. I didn't wanted to go back there. And so, you know, France, at least that was not this barrier of language, etc. So it was a little bit easier for me to go to France. Then at the time that, you know, I had the slight idea to come to live in the United States, George Bush got elected, so that's why I didn't come. And then until 2 months ago, I could smoke everywhere in France. That's why I stayed. How did you come to work with Kennedy and Marshall Company? Are you still your parents in Iraq? My parents are in Iran, dear. With Kennedy and Marshall Company, actually, at the beginning of the project, when we started the movie of Persepolis, Kathleen Kennedy, who is a big producer, Hollywood producer, who produced most of the movie of Spielberg, she wanted to buy the rights of the book. And so I answered back saying that, you know, the project has started. And she said that she wanted to be useful in the way that she could. And she is one of those examples that give you faith that, you know, like the whole Hollywood is not rotten. You know, some people, they really do things because they believe so. And she actually did. She helped us a lot. She supported a lot. She supported us a lot. She brought Sony Classics, who invested money into our movie. So that is the way they get involved. And yes, my parents, they still live in Iran. They are very fine, and they say hello to everybody. Okay. Do you think any age can write at the level of publishing, at the level of publishing level? Yes, I don't think that, you know, writing like anything else is a matter of intelligence, and intelligence is not a matter of age, unfortunately. It helps the age, of course, but not always. I cannot read this one, so I won't answer to it. So, okay. How do you personally feel about women who fight to wear hijab? This story of the scarf, actually, since I wrote a book, you know, that the first chapters start with veil. When this law against the veil came into France, everybody thought that I would be one of the first ones saying, yeah, let's forbid it, na-na-na. which was not the case. It was not the case because I was forced to put a veil on my head, and I didn't leave it good at all. And I'm not in the head of a religious person, and I don't know why a person would want to wear a veil. But forbidding for me that to somebody is as violent as pushing somebody to put it on their head. Plus, in France, that was other problem, and that made the woman to fight for the veil. Because in France, they said, yes, but, you know, these girls that they put, you know, a scarf in, on their head, the parents, they push them, and if they don't wear them, you know, the boys in their neighborhood will call them whores, and the parents, you know, I asked them the question many times. Well, the parents that push their daughter to put a veil on their head, if you don't, you forbid the school to this girl, wouldn't these parents be very happy to marry this girl at the age of 16 with some cousin that come, you know, from small village somewhere? Of course they would be. Let this girl be emancipated, and the only way for them to become emancipated would go through education. If we forbid them to come to school, they are punished two times. Once to be born in a family that pushed them to wear a scarf, and another time by the Republic that doesn't let them go and study. And at the same time, the boys that call them whores, they are sitting on the bench of school. They can continue study. So we have to let them the possibility of studying. So by making this law, actually, in France, what the creation, the day that they made this law, that was this 5,000 right extremist French fascist people, they came and they demonstrate into the street, and 5,000 Muslim fanatics, they came and they demonstrate in the street. And I think it's always better to make these people shut up and not give them any reason to come and demonstrate. That's what I think.
You've been listening to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. That was Iranian French graphic novelist Marjan Satrapi. This was her talk from 2007. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from the first 30 years of literary arts in Portland. And we have lots of other talks at our website. Listen to them all at literary-arts.org. The Archive Project is a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting, produced by Spencer Raymond. I'm Andrew Proctor. Thanks for joining us.